Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member and supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on, not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
Hi, this is Stuart A. Cuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009, when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores, and you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller. But I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God. And I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
We're live here on Blog Talk Radio. This is Carson's Corner, and my name is Bob Carson. Today's date is June 25th, 2014, and we are broadcasting in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. My name is Bob Carson. Listen, we got a great show for you today. We're going to talk a little bit later about the Boycott the Election campaign. There's a group on Facebook that I really think that you should consider joining. It's called the Election Boycott Advocates Group. It's on Facebook right now. It has over 300 members, and it's only been, you know, up there for a few days or so. It's rapidly expanding. And this is really spearheaded by Terry Lee, who, you know, I've worked with. I had Terry on the show in 2012. We had Mark E. Smith, author of the book Consent to Tyranny, Voting in the U.S. I probably got the title backwards, but he makes a lot of great points about why you should boycott the election, why you should not consent to tyranny. And let me tell you something. This is a topic that is so controversial. The idea of boycotting the election, the idea that our election system is invalid, you know, we all know that we have voting machines that are essentially owned by private for-profit companies. We all know that public opinion is not reflected in the decisions made by our elected officials, which really are elected, I would argue, by the business community to a large extent. And this idea, this, you know, premise, which really undermines the legitimacy of our system is so controversial. It's almost like talking about communism. It's almost like talking about Marxism. And, you know, any topic that is too controversial for the corporate media, any individual like Terry Lee, who is a true, genuine dissident, we want to have them on Carson's Corner. And we're going to be having Terry and a bunch of election boycott advocates, Christopher Driscoll and another individual, on the show in a week or so. It's going to be huge. It really is. Our last show with Mark E. Smith was really a highly listened to show. It appeared on many different websites, and it's very important. Mark E. Smith makes the point that breathing is not always good for you. In a toxic environment, if you continue to breathe, the worse your health gets. Well, you can make the same argument about our elections, right? Voting elections are not good for the American public, okay? And continuing to consent to a system which does not serve the needs and interests of the American people, I think that's absolutely clear, as demonstrated by capitalism in its current form. Doing so is only going to worsen the situation. And that kind of is a segue to what we're going to talk about in the first part of the show. By the way, if you want to give me a call, 347-326-9749. That is the number if you want to give me a call and be a part of the program. But the well-being of our population, okay, and this is one of the things that – this is one of the concepts in the Zeitgeist movement. The Zeitgeist movement, and, you know, I really recommend anybody that hasn't seen – the Zeitgeist films, they're very, very important. I'm not saying I agree with 100% with everything in the films, but let me tell you, the analysis presented as it pertains to our market system and our monetary system will force you to look at things in a different way. Because what we have right now in the corporate media, everything that you're told in the corporate media, and keep in mind that if you hear something, if you see something, if you read something, it's owned by just most likely one of six corporations, okay? And so therefore, what emerges from that is should be invalid, okay? Just my opinion. But basically, everything that we're told about our economy, everything – the yardsticks in which we measure progress are all economic abstractions that have nothing to do with the well-being of our society. And one of the things that is mentioned in the Zeitgeist films is that the GDP, okay, this is what we're told is supposed to raise the quality of life for the American people, right? It's all about growth. It's all about consumption. It's all about corporate profits and rates of inflation, and this is the rising tides lifts all boats, right? I mean, we're the richest country in the world, and therefore the quality of life in America is supposed to be aligned with our GDP. It's coupled together. The sequence of life is supposed to be correlated with the sequence of money, and this is how the world is presented to us through our corporate media. You know, everything is stocks. Everything is corporate earnings. The interests of labor accounts for absolutely nothing. Less than a very small percentage of the population actually is comprised of business owners, corporate profits really have no bearing. Wall Street, you know, the stock market has really no bearing on our lives. And this is presented to us as the end-all, be-all in terms of well-being. Our interests in the corporate media, the interest of working Americans, those that make their money through a wage or a paycheck, accounts for nothing. I mean, labor, as reported in the corporate media, is only reported as a nuisance to capital, right? And so all of this, the Zeitgeist movement argues, is the GDP is a product of industrial waste and inefficiency. Now, this is really a huge statement, but if you look at the facts in the United States, if you look at how the United States of America is one of the last ranking countries in terms of upwards mobility, we're one of the last ranking countries in terms of childhood poverty. In other words, the poverty rate among children is worse here than just about every industrialized country. We are last in terms of equality, the amount of income inequality and wealth disparity in this country is just astronomical. We are number one or very close to the top in homicides, suicides, all of the byproducts that go into living in a highly stratified society. And which we do exists here in America. And, you know, we're not told this by the corporate media, because once you start to realize that the more profits corporations earn, the wealthier the 1% become, it's worse for all of us. And, you know, this is a very, very important point, because what they are doing, what the elites in our society are doing, is they're confusing, purposely confusing the health of money with the health of human lives. And this is a system disorder, okay? I mean, you know, for example, let's take a look at our healthcare industry in America, okay? We are spending the most amount of money on our healthcare system than any industrialized country. The last time I checked, it was one out of every $6 we're spending towards healthcare, right? And on top of this, you have, you know, companies like United Healthcare with over 100 employees making $1 million a year. You've got Stephen J. Helmsley, former healthcare CEO, making $700 million. William McGuire making $1.7 billion. A lot of people are getting rich off of our healthcare system. And yet what this is a measure of sick and dying. It is a measure of inefficiency. Because another concept in the Zeitgeist movement argues that in order to maintain a competitive edge in the marketplace, the product that you release to the public has to be inefficient. It has to break down in order to maintain cyclical consumption. And that is absolutely true. You know, there are, I mean, you could look at many products offered on the market. You know, for example, let's take a look at cell phones. You know, I just lost my cell phone. Actually, I have no contacts left in my cell phone because I accidentally washed my cell phone. I left it in my pants pocket, and I put it in the washing machine. It's done. So I had to get a new cell phone, okay? But yet, my sister had a BlackBerry, but it was a Verizon BlackBerry. And so I could not use this cell phone with my cell phone provider because the industry wants me to consume another cell phone. They want me to buy another cell phone. Even though cell phones can be used, they could be manufactured to really go with any cell phone provider. So in other words, you know, if I had Metro PCS, which I do, and I lost my cell phone, I, you know, lost it, it got destroyed, I should be able to use another cell phone from whichever company to continue my service. But no, because things are made to maintain cyclical consumption, because things are made to break down Cost-cutting measures are put in every stage of production. Things break down, and there is a lifespan to each product that we consume here in this country. And so, you know, sustainability and efficiency are enemies of the marketplace. And you look at this and you realize why there is such a orchestrated effort to go after scientists, why there is such, you know, climate change denial, why the American public is polarized about climate change when the science is out there for all of us to examine. It's the same thing with, you know, you could just go look at industry after industry. And this is what we have here in America, where the entire marketplace is absolutely flawed. The GDP, the rise of our GDP, the rise of the products and services sold in our economy has nothing to do with the quality of life in America. And I've talked about this many times. You know, Ralph Nader has mentioned this, and he's been talking about this probably for longer than I've been alive. We don't measure our well-being in terms of what we're talking about, you know, healthcare outcomes, equality, social mobility. And that's a mistake, because Ralph Nader tells us he who controls the yardsticks controls the game. If we continue to vote in our election system, if we continue to, you know, treat our elections as if they have some sort of merit, and as if they will somehow benefit us, then all we're doing is just prolonging this. All we're doing is just making it worse for all of us. And I think that that's why, you know, the Zeitgeist movement and the election boycott movement, that's why it's sort of, they go hand in hand. Because they're essentially saying the same thing. All right? And another thing, too, that's very, very important, and this really forces you to think outside the box. We are told that the economy, based on conservatively orienting the materials for production and distribution of life-supporting goods, and that translates into the absence of waste. And that's what we're told, you know, the absence of waste. The private sector can always do it better than the government, right? You know, the government is just wasteful and inefficient. Well, you know, I don't want the government making my sneakers. I don't want the government making my computer. But if you look at some government programs, which derive many of its funding using, you know, socialist ideas like Medicare, the Veterans Administration, Social Security, these programs are quite efficient and they're run at a very low overhead. And I would submit to you that the private sector, in order to maintain a competitive edge, because they have to maintain a competitive edge to maintain cyclical consumption and to, you know, make a profit for its owners, has to be wasteful and inefficient. I mean, there's just no question about it. You look at the defense industry, another area of our economy that's extremely wasteful and inefficient. The House Republicans, if I'm not mistaken, a week or two ago, just approved a $600-plus billion spending bill when it comes to defense. And from my understanding, and I would have to go back, but I don't think there was much resistance to this bill. You look at our efforts in the Middle East and the ramping up of the, you know, defense industry, the war profiteers, the drumming the beat of war. And that's what we're seeing right now. And there is perhaps no other sector of our economy that is more wasteful and inefficient than our defense industry. I mean, look what the hell we've done in Iraq. Now Iraq is completely in chaos, right? We had even Dick Cheney, when he was defense secretary, saying that if we went into Iraq, it would be a quagmire. Well, it's a quagmire in Iraq. The social cost, the human cost of our occupation of that country has been immeasurable, and yet the defense industry is reaping huge profits. I mean, Halliburton now is a multi-billion-dollar company. I don't think they're called Halliburton anymore. But, you know, the richest zip code in the United States is Washington, D.C., because that's where all the defense contractors live. I mean, you've got Lockheed Martin. You've got, KBR. You've got all these – the CACI, all these different defense contractors that are getting billions and billions of dollars that are siphoning – our tax dollars. I mean, 50 cents of every tax dollar, federal tax dollar you spend is now going to defense. Defense spending has doubled since 1997. And yet that is a product of waste and inefficiency. That is industrial inefficiency at its finest, ladies and gentlemen. The more you see defense contractors rise in terms of profits, the worse it is for us socially, personally, and the worse it is for our environment. And you could take any sector. I mean, you look at the pharmaceutical industries in America. Waste and inefficiency, all on our dime. We're paying for it. We are. And they use the debt to structurally adjust us. And so, you know, these are all very, very important concepts that once you start to look at this, you really look at things a different way. Because at the end of the day, it's all about creating problems, okay? Doing the right thing in America, what I advocate on and many others advocate, abundance, sharing of resources, the addressing human needs, this does not create profits for anybody, okay? It's doesn't enter into the equation. The basis of rationale for this lies with the betterment of society. Our marketplace does the exact opposite. We tolerate a marketplace that does not take care of human needs. In fact, human needs are ruled out by default. We support an economic system that says that it's better that people go homeless, it's better that people go hungry, it's better that people go into bankruptcy than it is to create a sustainable environment. Because as we've said before, sustainability and efficiency are enemies of the marketplace. And so, you know, that is one of the things that we're seeing in our economy. If there's no profit there, if there's no money to be made, then it's discarded, it's marginalized, it's ruled out by default. We can go back to our health care system in America. Government-run health care, Medicare, Veterans Administration, which most veterans, most people receiving VA care have a high opinion of such care, is extremely efficient when you compare it to the private for-profit market. Okay, if we were to have universal health care in America, government-run health care, we'd be much better off in terms of health outcomes. There's really no question about that. But the problem is that there's no profit for that. The problem is that puts pressure on the private for-profit market in other areas, because if the government can – we're supposed to believe that the government can't do anything right. We're supposed to believe that the government stinks at everything. We're just supposed to ignore our reliance on the government. That would put pressure for us to, you know, apply the same concepts to education. You know, why do we have an education system that is wasteful and inefficient? I mean, that's another area of inefficiency in our economy. I mean, we have trillions of dollars in student loan debts. We have individuals like myself and others graduating only to work, you know, menial jobs. We have the students paying a much greater share of the student loan bills, whereas opposed to, you know, when Ronald Reagan was president, students paid maybe 20% of their tuition. Now that's reversed. Students are paying 80% of their tuition precisely because of lack of involvement when it comes to student loans. We privatized our student loan system. We've given it off to the banks, and now the banks have to make a profit. The banks have to, you know, make money. Cyclical consumption must be maintained. Indentured servants must submit to employment. And as a result now, we have a system which is completely unsustainable. But, you know, if the government went back, if we started, you know, doing what we did during the period after World War II with the GI Bill, if we started to get the private banks out of our education system, you wouldn't have individuals graduating with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt. But again, this is a social cost. This is a byproduct of a sick system that we have here in America. It's really, really remarkable. But this is what we have to realize here, and this is what we have to look at, okay? It's important to realize that if you look at the economy, everything must break down. Everything must be inferior the moment it is released. And in this facet, everything, you know, the negative, you know, problems that we have, the conditions associated with capitalism, crime, terrorism, mass incarceration, they're good for the business community. Remember, Michael Rupert, the journalist, said, create a problem, create profits. Okay, problems create profits. There's no profits in creating abundance. There's no profits in dealing with the well-being of our citizenry. There is no, you know, there is nothing profitable about that. And that, you know, it reflects a sick value system. Our values have adjusted to basically uphold the system. We're going to take a brief time out. We'll be right back. I want to talk about the boycott the election campaign that's going on. Actually, you know, we have a caller. We'll get to the caller. Actually, he's been on hold for a while. Sorry about that. We'll get to the caller after this brief timeout here on Carson's Corner. You're listening to Carson's Corner on Blog Talk Radio in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. My name is Bob Carson, and we'll be right back after this brief timeout.
Got no car, so I got no soul. No parole, no control. Food, I got my number on a wiretap. Cuts like Jack, but Similac. Fuck a Cadillac, so fine. One motive, no focus. Every sidewalk, the focus like a tightrope. Yes, I know my deadline, sire. With my life is fire, I'm sending the resemblance of the barbed wire. The mother of my genre, lose her mind at my grave. It's my life for that life, so call it a free trade. Well, neither am I even born a star. I took a death trip when I tried to cross the white wall.
take over, track is moving also. I'm heading north like my name was Kit Dex. I'll touch no vibe, one motive, no hope. It's hard to breathe with Wilson dead around my throat. Strangled and mangled another SS curtain call. When I try to cross the white wall. Walker seat back, a freeze in the gate. Born without a fate. One moment, no hope. Born without a fate. Walker seat back, a freeze in the gate. Born without a fate. One moment, no hope. Born without a fate.
Lamar Waldron, the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, those two books, the latter of which will become a movie produced and starring Leonardo DiCaprio in 2013. And you are listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson on Underground Progressive Radio.
All right, we're back here on Carson's Corner. My name is Bob Carson, and we are running in conjunction with the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. Make sure to check out that site for great, independent, non-corporate-owned, non-corporate-sponsored, progressive material, material such as what you're hearing on this show. Very, very good stuff. It's so important because, you know, our landscape, our media landscape, we don't have a voice. We just don't. You know, that's why one of the reasons why at the top of the show I play Voice of the Voiceless by Rage Against the Machine, because they control the discourse. Don't you understand that? The elites, well, I'm sorry, I don't mean to, but it's just frustrating, like, that there are individuals out there that don't even believe this, that the elites in our society control the discourse, which is why everything comes back to the libertarians, everything comes back to the Ryan budget, everything comes back to the Tea Party, right? They control the discourse, and when they're not in power, the elites control the election system, which brings us to a very, very important effort. It's the Election Boycott Advocates Group on Facebook. And, you know, we had Terry Lee on the show. We're going to have her on in the future, maybe in a week or so. And I invite everybody to join this group because it's very, very important stuff being discussed in this book. And Terry Lee made the prediction in this group that the establishment will start the 2016 election by giving us stories about the history of the Voting Rights Act and the Freedom Summer and so on and so forth. And the reason – and she's absolutely right. It's actually a brilliant prediction. The reason why that's going to happen is to – legitimize the system to make you believe that voting is so important. Look, these individuals died for the right to vote, and maybe to a certain extent that is correct. But now the material conditions of capitalism, the deterioration has just gotten so great now, and all the problems that we discussed before the break, the social degradation of our society, how negative attributes are rewarded by our current system, makes it just impossible to go forward. As Noam Chomsky says, both political parties are factions of the business party. We have one political party in America, and I think that's absolutely correct, and that's what you're going to see from PBS, which is corporate sponsored. The legitimizing of our election system, and I think she's absolutely right. So go check out the content over at the Election Boycott Advocates Group on Facebook, and keep your ears tuned in right here to Carson's Corner. We're going to go to a phone caller right now. I believe this is my old friend Jason calling us from North Jersey. Jason, is that you, my friend? Jason? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me?
I'm there.
Jason?
Are you my friend?
Yes, it is.
Hey, what's up, brother? How are you?
You hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, my friend. How are you doing?
Hey, good.
Good, man. Well, I mean, listen, it's been a while. I know that you follow this stuff to a certain extent. You have a very, very unique take on these issues that we're talking about. So, you know, what do you want to talk about?
Pretty much that you've I want to almost touch on everything that you brought up, because I can believe how eloquent and how spot on you are with all of the things that you've talked about. I mean, you really got my mind going. And the thing is, I'm not really too much into the whole political agendas, because I don't like to stay up on current events, because I already kind of know, just from living and experiencing, what the things that are going on, what's really going on. And I mean, the last thing you said about the Republicans and the Democrats, two-party system.
Yep.
And how it's basically a soap opera to entertain citizens of America, because if you make, let's say you have one party that really wants to control everything, then people are going to get upset and might, you know, rebel against tyranny. But if you split it into two quarreling sides and give them each opposing opinions on important issues that are going on in society, then you will split the citizens of the USA.
And yeah, I agree. And the only thing that I would say is that on core issues, I would say that the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans, I mean, on social issues, right, like gay marriage, there's a difference. Although they say that the opposition to gay marriage is deteriorating. On issues like abortion, all right, they're far apart on abortion. But I would argue, and this is, I think, what Noam Chomsky was saying, that essentially on core issues that affect the bottom line, issues of privatization, issues
they agree.
Of, yeah, exactly.
Oh, I'm totally with you. But the whole thing is, those other issues are a distraction for us.
Yep.
Because if you shine a shiny light and start blinking it, you know, people will tend to look towards that shiny light instead of seeing the person who's coming behind them and taking all their possessions away from them, or their rights, or their, I mean.
You know, Jason, I've known you since 2007, and I'm listening to you speak, and you're obviously a very, very thoughtful person. And I just want to ask you, you know, you said that you don't follow it that much because basically, you know, your life experience tells you, you know, what is going to happen and everything like that. Do you think that, and I would submit that to a certain extent, that the reason why you don't follow it too much is that there's a certain amount of apathy. There's a certain amount of frustration on your part as it pertains to our current system. And I would also, you know, say that basically you do not view, from what it sounds like, you do not view the current system, like maybe the election system in America, as being valid.
Hasn't been valid ever since the Constitution was written. I mean, right after the Bill of We the People, the preamble, the start of the Bill of Rights, it says automatically about the Electoral College. So it's not a government for the people by the people. I mean, we don't get to elect who we want to elect for the job. We get to elect the two people that they put up for election, and it's two sides of the same coin. Whoever wins, the core objectives that they want are going to get passed.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at Obama and look at his campaign he ran in 2008, and it was about change and about freedom and about coming together, and he made promises even during his presidency about getting the soldiers home by out of Afghanistan by before New Year's Eve. And none of that has happened at all, and none of that has come to fruition. So,
well, you know what? I was at the Left Forum a couple months, actually earlier in this month, I believe it was. And you know what's funny is that one of the speakers said that here we are, we have a black president, right? I mean, we'll all basically say, you know, President Obama is a black man. We have a government surveillance running amok. We have the continued mass incarceration of black America. We have stop and frisk, which recently ended with the election of Bill de Blasio. But it proves to you how inflexible the system is, where we have a black man in the White House, supposedly, and obviously we know whose interest Obama has at heart, but you know, just on the surface of things, it just shows you how inflexible the system is.
Well, that's the thing is, what I was going to elaborate on is, I don't believe that Obama was being ingenuine with the things he wanted to do. I think he was just naive in the fact, in what he thought the abilities of the president really were. And when he basically stepped into, you know, a hot pool of something when he entered into the White House, and reality shows its face. The only president to ever go against the constituency,
mm-hmm.
JFK, John F. Kennedy Jr. He played ball to get into office with all the right people. He got into office, and he started to expose them in his speeches, and he started to talk about not to stray from controversy and to ask the truth of things, and that he wants full disclosure of his presidency and his, what do you call it? Bob,
transparency?
Yeah, no, he wanted transparency of his, not regime, but you know what I mean.
The CIA?
No. It's like the president and the
executive branch?
Yeah, all that. The whatever.
His cabinet?
All of that, but you would call it, it's a general term. It's basically the political powers that are at be at that time. You know, he wanted full disclosure, full transparency of what him and his people were doing. And he said he encouraged the people to ask questions about the government. He encouraged the newspapers. He said he even mentioned about the newspapers not telling the real news, and how that is a crime against the citizens of the United States.
Right.
And,
you know,
we all know what happened to him. So,
yeah.
So someone like Obama, who I'm sure, he started from the ground up. He was a progressive person. He made a lot of changes for the city of Chicago, and he could have probably been a lawyer making, a criminal lawyer or whatever, a real estate lawyer, and making millions of dollars. Instead, he decided to do, public works, social services and to help the community. So
we
thought it was in the right place, but the thing is, when you're staring in front of a loaded gun and you're being asked, are you going to say yes or no? A lot of people are going to say, they're going to say yes,
Exactly. And it's interesting that you brought up JFK because I would really, and I hate to really sound sinister here, but I really think this is the truth that, if President Obama were an individual of change, if he put in place policies that would reflect his campaign rhetoric going back to 2008, if they say that the dissidents really challenge the system often create the most resistance from the system. So, let's say for argument's sake that I got elected president or you got elected president or whatever. You would get pressure from the Federal Reserve. You'd get pressure from the defense industry. You get pressure from other financial institutions. And then
basically, you're coming into office and you're finding out that you're not really the president.
Exactly.
There's other people who, I know this is for the politics of the United States of America, but me personally, what I feel is that it's the same people who are running everything all around the world.
Yes. That's why we have, the financial summits. It used to be we have the G20, and now we have the G8, and this is what David Harvey says, and I'd really suggest that maybe look up some YouTube videos of him or some speeches. He's a professor, and he spoke at the Left Forum that I recently attended. But he makes the argument that at the rate we're going right now with the financialization of our economy and the fact that decisions are not made by the people, just micro decisions like where to put a park, where to put a new freeway or whatever are going to be made at the local level. But all the major decisions of our economy are going to be made at the level of the G8, the financial institutions of America. And you could look back to 2008, Jason, with the financial collapse, where who was it on television? It was the state finance nexus, as David Harvey calls them, the elite group of bankers that essentially told the government what we're going to do and told the American people. It wasn't the president. It wasn't our leaders. Right. And that speaks volumes about, what has transpired to our country. So I think, it is a global banking cartel, which they serve as proxies for the transnational corporations. But I want to go back to my point about President Obama earlier, is that if President Obama...
Wait, can I just... On what you just said real quick?
Go ahead, yeah.
Just as to throw out a possible solution to all of that, you boycott and cut the pipeline of cash going to these corporations and companies. I mean, it's the citizens do have the power because we have the numbers, but they have power because they control the media and they have the money. So if we basically detox off of the things that, like cell phones and laptops and, stuff like that. I mean, the internet is a beneficial thing because we could communicate with people all around the world.
Right.
But keep it moderate, in moderation. We don't need to continue to buy their the newest iPhone or the newest
right.
iPad that comes out. We boycott them, like just like they did in the 60s with protesting. But protesting won't work nowadays because the police will they're becoming more of a imposing
agents.
Physical threat.
Yeah.
They're imposing their physical authority more and more.
They're agents of the bourgeoisie, and this extends to the military, this extends to the court system, and to a certain extent, you're right, this all emanates from cash. I mean, you know, why do we have a Supreme Court right now that rules almost always in favor of big business and against labor? These individuals were put there by money, and so, yeah, many people think that, you know, money is the root of all evil, and money is the root problem, and I think to a certain extent that's correct. And what you're talking about, the rampant consumerism.
Bob, money is a symptom of evil. It's a tool that was used by evil. You know, and if you want to label good and evil, I really think that, you know, it's two sides of the same coin. It's degrees. They're on the same spectrum. Evil is the least good that you can be, and good is the least evil that you can be. So they're really one and the same.
Right.
And it's that type of separation which enables those who are controlling to separate us. But it started out, we used to, in ancient civilizations, we used to trade and barter with actual things that were necessities. You know, if you
right.
had chickens, then I had a goat, and you needed milk, we would trade. And then at some point, you know, in quote-unquote evil genius thought up, hey, let's make these shiny metals worth something, which you can't eat them. There's not enough to build a shelter. You can't clothe yourself with them. And then over time, they said, hey, you know what? Instead of the shiny metals, we'll keep the shiny metals, and then we'll make a paper form of currency. And we'll make that worth the shiny metal, which is worth food and necessities. And then now we've even gotten to a point where we don't even really have cash. We have a bank statement that comes out of the ATM machine that tells us how much money we have.
Yep.
And most people do their banking online anyway, so now it's just on a computer screen. So it's not even real. Doesn't even really exist.
Money is treated as a commodity, and money is pursued for the sake of money. And what you're talking about, I think, is mentioned in, we talked about the Zeitgeist films, how, you know, John Locke introduced his three provisos for just property, and then somewhere along the line, it Adam Smith comes along and says that there doesn't have to be enough. There's no limit to how much labor you can buy, no longer is there any consideration. Money spoils, whether or not money spoils, because it's a commodity. It's like gold, and gold can't spoil. And this is really almost the foundations of capitalism. And now it's at a point where, you know, money, I'm sure you're familiar with the fractional reserve banking system in America, and how debt and bankruptcy are inherent in the system. And then, and now we're at a point where
I look throughout the history of mankind, and throughout human civilization there has always been some form of people being enslaved,
right?
And it started out by physical force, you know, like the Egyptians enslaved the Jews, physically enslaved them through chains and shackles and physical intimidation. And then the same thing with, slavery is still going on today in that same type of form in places. But in America, we're in economic slavery.
Right.
We're encouraged and because human beings are very easily influenced. Because we want to follow each other, because we yearn for connection with one another. We yearn for peace, you know, but also we yearn for conflict sometimes too. But a lot of times conflict brings about peace if the two people are reasonable and honest and have integrity. But what I'm trying to say is that we are being influenced into a direction that makes our I know my generation, which is your generation, because we're about the same age, and in the 90s and stuff like that, after high school, you go to college. After college, you know, or you meet a nice girl, you get married. You meet a nice girl, you get married, you try to buy a home because it's important to own a home. And then from there, you have children. And, you know, and these are the things that were promoted from another source, not from the actual family unit, but from another source, and just kept being handed down and handed down. But now they're getting so greedy that it's like it's not enough the way they had it. Now it's like you go to college and you pay these outrageous student loans, and like you said, the privatization of it, like Mohila, who's one of those companies who took over the government student loans and the financial aid. And now you can't even get a job for most of the professions that you're going for.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you do get a job, you're going to be paying off the student loans for the next 25 years.
Yep.
And inflation has kept going up, and deflation of wages has been going down, you know? And the minimum wage they keep raising it every now and then. I mean, I think it's somewhere near maybe close to $8 now.
Yeah.
But there's no way there's no possible way someone can support. Not even two people working at $8 an hour could support themselves.
Exactly. Because it's
together
been,
on $8 an hour.
It has not kept up with productivity, and it's deteriorated over time. Yes, since the 60s. We're running up on a couple minutes, Jason. We've got like maybe 1 or 2 minutes.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that they're basically just slowly, it's called erosion, you know, like the water does to rock, it slowly erodes it. They're beating the human spirit slowly. They're beating us into a comatose, distracted by the radio waves coming off of the TV, off of the internet, off of the phone. I mean, those things are hypnotizing in a way, you know? And I'm not like a conspiracy theorist or anything like that. I just call it like I see it from just living life and just watching television and partaking in all these things. And they want us to be almost, they either want us to just like be so distraught that we just give up, or they want us to uprise so that they can use their superior firearms and military and privatized armies to, basically take control of everything physically.
Yep. And that's exactly what happened, I would argue, with the Occupy protests, where we don't see an Occupy movement because of government coordination, similar to what we saw in the 70s with COINTELPRO and everything. Jason, listen, thanks a lot for the call. It was great, very thought-provoking. And we hope that you call the show more often. It was very, very good to speak to you. Thank you for once again,
Jason.
Thank
you. Goodbye.
Take care. All right, that was Jason from North Jersey. Big thanks for the phone call. We're just about out of time here. My name is Bob Carson. You can friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. Make sure to check out the Election Boycott Advocates on Facebook. And also, of course, make sure to support the CommonsProjectNetwork.com. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.